Good morning. Starting Monday, the Hawaii Farm to School Initiative moves from testing to daily menus in the Kohala Complex pilot program. We'll talk with Chef Greg Christian, who's made it his mission to bring local food and healthy, tasty meals kids will eat into the nation's schools while saving the money. And after public comments, revisions, and additions, the Hamakua Community Development Plan is now under review by the Hawaii County. Brad Kurakawa, the chairperson of the Plan Steering Committee, joins us later this hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Styles of regional music from all parts of the country come together in Americana, and John Ridgway of Discord and Rise in our studio. And we'll talk about Game of Thrones, the musical.
It's a Friday, January 6th. That's the conversations that will start right after this news. Good morning and welcome to an Aloha Friday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and this is The Conversation. And to my right, as ever, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Most of us don't have particularly happy memories of the food we were served in school.
Would you have an unhappy memory?
Oh, well, actually, I liked some of them, but, cream chip beef and various other dishes that we haven't seen since.
Yeah, I can hear a lot of people going, ew.
Yeah.
Well, for me, going to school, we didn't have a cafeteria. Most of it was just home lunch. But for a lot of kids who do go to the cafeteria, not only for lunch, but for breakfast and often after school snacks, they know this, that, you know, most of the food tastes pretty bland at best. And at worst, it doesn't even make it into their mouths. Now, with so much of the food pre-prepared, it's also tough for kids to learn good eating habits. Unless Chef Greg Christian comes to their school, he's made it his mission to craft school meals in concert with the kids who'll eat them and the kitchen staff who'll make them from scratch using locally sourced food. As part of the Hawaii Farm to School Initiative, Chef Greg is working on the pilot program in the Kohala Complex, and the new school menus start on Monday. Chef Greg joins us now on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
How did you transition from being a chef in restaurants and doing catering to wanting to move into school food?
That's a great question. First, it's an honor to be on your show today. Thanks for having me. I was your typical chef, you know, making food and trying to make fancy food in Chicago. And then my youngest daughter was really sick, and the doctors couldn't help her. And we started feeding her all organic food because we were kind of desperate to try to figure out how to get her healthy. And she got better. And then I realized over time that I didn't just care about what my two kids eat for lunch, because we sent them to school with fabulous scratch-made food that, you know, we made. And then I just realized I cared what all kids ate in school. I can't really explain why I care, but it just happened and kind of took over. So I transitioned out of fancy food and started to figure out how to solve the puzzle, you know, in school food. It's a complicated puzzle because the budget's so tight. So how do you do better food in a tight budget with staff that aren't necessarily totally experienced cooks? Some are, but a lot of them aren't. So how do you do it? And so I just kind of jumped in.
You were selected, you and your organization was selected last year to be part of the pilot program and to basically create a whole new way of creating food for kids, and you do that in concert with the kids. What did you do when you sat down with them? What did they tell you?
Well, first of all, they're very... I work all over North America, and here the kids ended up being, like, really quiet, which I didn't really know. I'd never been to Hawaii, so I didn't realize that. So what I started to do was I started to, I worked with the ladies, and it's all lady women in this particular cafeteria, and I said, what do you think the kids want to eat? Because you're from here. All the women here went to this school. Their kids went to this school. Their grandchildren are all in the school. So it's a tiny community, and everybody knows each other. And they told me what they think the kids would want to eat. So I said, okay, let's make that food. And so they showed me. I didn't know how to make lau lau, and I didn't know how to make Kahlua pork and cabbage. So they showed me, and so we made it together. And then I brought it with the head of food service here, Priscilla, to the kids and fed it to them and said, is this something you'd like? And no one said anything, you know, almost no one. They just kind of stared at me like, who's this new person, and we're not going to talk to him, or whatever was going through their mind. So then somebody smarter than me said, well, let's give them a survey that they can write on. And then I started to hear all about what they thought about the samples we served and what they wanted to see.
And what did they tell you?
I would tell them that they're the customer. I would say it like 7-8 times in my 10-minute meeting with them. And I would go to classrooms to get them in the cafeteria. They're with a lot of people, and they're going to stay quiet, or you know, they feel a little safer in the classroom. So I would do 10-minute sampling in the classroom. They would write what they thought, and then that's when I learned what the customer, which are the kids, like really want.
And what did they tell you when you got those surveys back?
Well, they were like, they wanted, like, they serve pizza here, and everyone here was doing the best they can to make the best pizza they could make, right? And I said, well, let me help you. Let's see. And so the kids said, we want pizza, but we want it better than the one we have. So I went to the ladies and said, is it okay if I help you make it better? They said yes. So then we changed the crust with all the same ingredients. We changed the sauce. You know, we went from buying pizza sauce to making it. And we, you know, we're going to try grating our own cheese instead of buying grated cheese. So little things. And then I went back and fed it to them. And I said, is this what you mean? And now they're talking. And they're like, you know, it's good, but we really want more sauce. And we really want less cheese, or whatever they said. I can't remember. And so then we went back and made it again, and we brought it back. So things like that. You know, we made them a chicken adobo sandwich. And, you know, with a green papaya slaw. Like, is this edible? Do you want it? Can we make it better? If we serve it, will you buy it? And so they said a lot. You know, they wanted the lau lau. They wanted a lot of the food. Like, they want chicken fingers, right? And they want hamburgers. And they just want them to be better. And so can you make them better?
Right. So, I mean, kid food that is appealing and appetizing, I mean, appealing to the eye as well as appetizing to taste buds, especially with kids who can be really picky, or because, you know, they don't like the food, will be very predisposed to just tossing it in the trash. And there's so much waste. And when you think about how much milk gets wasted on an average day, how is it that you were able to work with them to understand, too, about eating their food because it was good and locally sourced and foods that they were familiar with but tasted better, but also to understand that, you know, the food's meant to be eaten?
Yeah, people, you know, I'm just the next piece of the puzzle in this state. There's been people working for 10 years, you know, Nancy Redfeather, all, you know, the Kohala Center, Ulupono, all kinds of great, smart people trying to improve the food and get kids to eat it. And so there's a fabulous garden here in the grammar school and in the high school that's been going for years. So what I'm doing is I'm just trying to work with all those different narratives that have already happened and are continuing to happen and converge them into the cafeteria.
And does that include working with local farmers and those who have been asked to participate in this so that, you know, they can have a dependable source of income? They know what a school is going to need on an average day, and also connecting the kids to the farms where the stuff is all coming from?
Yeah, we haven't done that yet. We have local food. We go live Monday in this model. And so we have some local food here that we bought through a distributor. We're trying to buy as much. We're going to buy a lot of local food here and track exactly how much dollars spent on it. There's some rules, you know, that are set up for around food safety. that's, I'm not going to say limiting our ability to buy local, but, you know, we're trying to work in the current system to buy as much local food as we can.
And not have it cost any more.
The thing that people don't realize, so yeah, to answer your question, there's a lot of narratives to converge, right? So we're standing on the shoulders of giants that have been working on this for over 10 years. Giants, Kohala Center, you know, just, I mean, I could just keep name dropping the Dorrance family, right?
Well, we've got to go pretty soon, so don't name drop anymore.
Good.
But
I'm done. So yeah, we're working on converging all the narratives, but it's most important that the ladies in the cafeteria can make the food and that the kids eat it. And then as that's happening, we'll head more and more to local food.
Okay, so tell me, what's Monday's menu?
Monday, you know, I don't have it in front of me, and I should have it in front of me, but I can tell you that Thursday we're doing this chicken adobo slider that I'm so excited about. Monday we're doing quesadillas with roasted tomato salsa, all homemade.
If I were closer, I'd come to you for lunch. But for the moment, I've got to say goodbye.
It's an honor. Thanks so much for putting this project in front of people.
And thanks for all of your good work and for joining us this morning. Greg Christian was once dubbed the Obi-Wan Kenobi of Chicago's sustainability movement by a Chicago journalist. He's a chef, consultant, and author who has been helping to transform food service with his team Beyond Green Sustainable Food Partners. The school meals developed with the kids and the kitchen staff in the Kohala Complex for the Farm to School Initiatives pilot program start on Monday.
Your family gathering this holiday involve arguing over climate change? I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, we'll talk about the best evidence to sway a global warming skeptic. Plus, physicist, now Congressman Dr. Bill Foster talks about robots taking over jobs. And a trip to Gadget Nirvana, the Consumer Electronics Show. All on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after The Conversation.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:16, and coming up in the show, Americana music from Discord and Rye. But first, your quiz.
You might remember that yesterday we talked with the new chair of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, Rowena Akana. Today we're going to talk to you a little bit about OHA's beginnings. It was established in the 1970s as a semi-autonomous department of the state of Hawaii. It was created in response to a provision in the 1959 Admission Act, which entered Hawaii into statehood. That provision directed the newly created state of Hawaii to hold lands in a public trust to support public education, infrastructure, home ownership, farming, and bettering the condition of Native Hawaiians. Despite the provision, it was not until several years later that the Office of Hawaiian Affairs was created to fulfill that intent. So for today's backyard quiz, we'd like to know if you know what legislative event created OHA and in what year did that event take place. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right will get the prize.
I'm Chaplain John Smith from the 2nd Battalion, 27th Infantry Regiment, the Wolfhounds. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
This country's regional musical traditions have long since burst past their borders. You no longer have to go to Kentucky to hear real bluegrass. You don't have to go to Mississippi to hear country blues. And if you enjoy any of them, you're ready to embrace the Americana movement, in which young musicians merge all the styles of music that are made by the people for the people. Discord and Rye, an Americana band, will be performing tomorrow evening in our Atherton Performing Arts Studio. And his guitarist, John Ridgway, is with us this morning. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
You grew up in the South, yeah?
Yeah, I did. I grew up in Smoky Mountains in North Carolina and then Virginia as well.
So bluegrass music was all around you, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
But as you know, it used to be anyway that, you, as I was saying just now, you really had to go to the South to hear real bluegrass. You had to go to the Deep South to hear country blues. But now you can hear it just about anywhere, yeah?
Yeah, that's correct. If you do go to the South, you don't really have an option. It's absolutely everywhere. And the thing is that it has taken off and spread throughout, you know, pretty much all over the world. I was over in the UK a few years back, and I was surprised. I was hearing more bluegrass music on the radio there than I did back home in the States. So yeah. It's all over the world now. It's great.
What do you think is the source of its appeal?
I think it's because it's a very honest and just talent driven style of music. There's really nothing to hide behind, and it's just raw and honest and completely down to earth. Because you don't find that a lot with music these days. So I think people are just kind of drawn to it because it's just very natural and honest.
You know, when you think of the stories that get told in bluegrass songs or folk songs and in blues songs, they frequently sort of come together. So traditions that you think were kind of separate, right, might even do the same song with, different chords. Or you might hear, Sitting on Top of the World done as a bluegrass song.
Oh, yeah.
Or as a country song or as a Chicago blues song.
Yeah, that's true. It's very true. Some of the songs that we have is there's a couple of songs I've written, and it's basically blues songs just sped up, and they sound like bluegrass, but they were written as blues songs.
When you go to write a song, what do you start with? Do you start with like a story that you want to tell, or what's your sort of point of origin for those?
I usually just start with an absolute need to play a new song, mm-hmm. and then I kind of go with a pick a story that I've told over the years, and I kind of know it, and I just kind of turn it into music. A lot of the songs that we have, they're all like true stories. Mm-hmm. Our old bass player Ronnie, he and I would write together, and we would just write songs about things that have happened to us, things we've seen, people we've met, and it just goes from there.
That's pretty much the way the original songwriters did it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's where a lot of that appeal comes. It's very clear that it's a personal experience told by the person who lived it, in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Most of it is just storytelling. If you listen to all the old, the heavy hitters from back of the day with, countries like Hank Williams and Johnny Cash, those are just stories that are being told.
Yeah. And, I think that if you've got a story that's deeply felt, then the music no longer becomes one of these things that rise and fall with fashion. You know that they seem to last longer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they have a classic quality to them that appeal across generations. I remember when I first heard Hank Williams. My dad was a Southern Baptist preacher, and I wasn't allowed to listen to any secular music at all. I was just gospel on the Sunday mornings. Mm-hmm. And then I was working on a car with my grandfather, and he started playing Hank Williams, and I looked up at him, and I remember it like blew my mind because I never heard anything like it. And I told him I'd never heard it, and so we just sat there and listened to Hank, throughout the morning while we worked on this car, and that's where it kind of started with me. But it was, it was my grandfather, and I was his grandson, and it still appealed to me.
Yeah.
I don't know how many other genres of music that you can actually apply that to. Maybe all of them, if they're good, if they're just good, solid music. But that's what kind of, it just, that's what kind of always like drew me to this style of music. It's kind of timeless.
Well, you know, it's a good thing the first artist you heard was Hank Williams, because, you know, that's starting right at the top, isn't it?
Yeah, he's pretty great. Yeah, he always makes you stop. Like, whenever you hear Hank, everyone just kind of pauses and, you know, have that look like, yeah, you listen to Hank right on.
Yeah. I don't think that he's been surpassed, and that's a pretty good example of the lasting quality, because there's nothing locked in. You know, that's those songs were late 40s, early 50s, mm-hmm. and yet they don't feel locked into a time period at all, do they?
No. I mean, they're still relevant. And like this morning, I was walking out of the house, and my roommate was listening to Hank. I didn't know he listened to Hank, and I was like, hey, man, nice song. He's like, yeah, Hank. I was like, cool, all right, I got to go. But like you said, they have an incredibly, just an incredible lasting quality to them that, you know, keeps it going.
Do you mix your own songs in with, you know, classics like Hank and
sometimes we do. I like to play music because I've been lucky enough to meet some pretty amazing musicians that have been, you know, pushing this style of music or are working within this genre to kind of keep it going, or, you know, or writing the same, telling the same stories, that sort of thing. And so I like to play their songs as well, because they do have that lasting quality and they don't have that exposure, and it's more like a word of mouth thing. But from time to time, we will break out some. We'll do like a Johnny Cash, Hank Williams medley with their songs, and just go from one verse to one song to a verse to another verse to another.
Yeah.
And my bass player Nick Danger, him and I will sing back and forth. He's got a very, very good Hank Williams sound to his singing style. So it's nice to do that, and it always keeps the crowd going. They hear something they know, and they, you know,
sure,
they dig it.
Well, geez, has it been easy for you to find musicians that understand the whole feel that you're looking for?
Yeah, it has been. I've been lucky enough to find some pretty great guys over the years. Right now, we're working with Caroline Pond, who's like she's from Asheville, North Carolina. That's the same country, part of the country I'm from, mm-hmm. and she's kind of a legend out there. And she's out. She moved out here. And a promoter was like, you know, you should meet up with her and get linked up with her and see if you can get her to play with you. And I just thought she was kind of out of her league. And we kind of played phone tag a lot. And I never really thought we'd actually, like, nail her down. And then we started texting one day, and we were playing this festival over the Coal Owls. I just invited her out to come out, and then I met her, and literally 15 minutes later, we're on stage, and we're, you know, playing songs and everything.
That's how it works.
Yeah. Now, we've been playing ever since, and everyone thinks we're related because we both have a similar accent. Hers is a little bit more thick than mine, but, yeah.
It all to the good. Thanks a lot, John, for coming in.
Oh, yeah, no problem.
John Ridgway plays guitar in Discord and Rye, the Americana band that will be performing tomorrow evening in our Atherton Performing Arts Studio. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
Next time on The World, an animal lover travels around the globe helping zoos make life more interesting for their elephants and chimpanzees. She says animals need to be able to make choices, even in captivity.
If you have no choice, you feel helpless, you feel hopeless, you feel angry, depressed. It's the same with animals.
Bringing out the wild in zoo animals on The World.
This morning at 11, right after Science Friday. Support for The Conversation comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
Today, Senator Mazie Hirono is scheduled to meet with Secretary of Defense nominee James Mattis. The retired four-star Marine general seems likely to be confirmed. So what might that mean for already military-heavy Hawaii? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
So Mad Dog seems to be liked by both Republicans and Democrats. Does that also include Hawaii's congressional delegation?
Colleen Hanabusa has never met the general, but our Kirsten Downey did talk to her and had a generally good impression. Got a statement from Hirono as well, who is worried about Mr. Trump and his proclivities. There's some hope that he might be able to, and by he, I mean Mattis, help rein in the president from some of his more adventurous comments. There's a general, but you said it right at the top. He is admired by both Democrats and Republicans, which is frankly rather rare among the nominees. I would say among all of President-elect Trump's nominees, Mattis has been the most uniformly accepted. So probably a pretty good bet that he's going to be confirmed.
And that despite the fact that he wasn't particularly well embraced by the Obama administration.
No, there was a falling out there, and today I hear in D.C. that there's actually some clashing within the Trump administration, the transition team over Mattis, but that's probably nothing new either. You know, you mentioned his nickname being Mad Dog. There's another nickname I found out from Kirsten Downey's report. He's also known as the Warrior Monk, meaning that he takes a thoughtful approach to warfare. So that's a side of the general that I wasn't aware of. In terms of what it might mean for Hawaii, you know, remember, Hawaii is the headquarters for U.S. Pacific Command, and that concerns 55% of the Earth's surface. Colleen Hanabusa said, you know, after the Pentagon, we have the second most dense military concentration in the world. All four branches of the military are here. Oahu is particularly heavily concentrated with military personnel. So in that sense, probably a good thing with Mattis coming on board, given Trump's desire to expand the naval fleet and to spend more money on the military.
So a sense that perhaps we might see even more of a ramp up in Hawaii?
Quite possible. Remember that North Korea is a growing threat, China as well. Even ISIS is making inroads into the Asia-Pacific region, not just in the Middle East and Africa and Europe. So with that attention, there will be a real pivot to Asia, perhaps not diplomatically, but militarily, a concern in that area, economically as well.
And any word from the U.S. Pacific Command how they're viewing this?
Well, you know, the commander here for PACOM has definitely taken a strong view on China, saying that these islands that are being created in the South China Sea are unacceptable, and a sense that having one of their own, a retired four-star general leading the Defense Department, it's probably got a lot of military personnel happy.
Well, it looks like this very well may be going forward, and maybe better than some of the other nominees that have a lot more controversy attached to them. Thanks, Chad, and we'll see you on Monday.
Thanks, Beth Ann. Take care.
Chad Blair joins us every day with a reality check from Civil Beat. Preserving rural boundaries while still planning for growth is the balancing act faced by most communities in Hawaii. For the Hamakua District on the northeast side of Hawaii Island, that task has been the work of the Hamakua Community Development Plan Steering Committee. It's a citizens' advisory group to the Hawaii County Planning Department. After last year's public comments, revisions, and additions, the Hamakua plan is on its way to the county. Brad Kurokawa is the steering committee's chairperson. He joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Trying to hold that line between what needs to stay rural and why there needs to be more growth is really difficult for most communities. How was it for Hamakua?
I think, you know, as you mentioned, you know, it's a phenomena that is occurring everywhere. And so we, you know, we face the same challenges, not just on the Hamakua coast, but, you know, the statewide as well as, you know, other districts within our island as well.
You know, the Hamakua coast is so beautiful, and, you know, people choose to be there for very different reasons than they choose to be other places. Were there specific areas of Hamakua, you know, because it's not just the coastline, but sort of goes in almost triangle-like shape into the interior of the island. Were there different factions that were having very different feelings about what that line of rural versus growth should be?
Well, I think, you know, when we go back, you know, sort of looking at the, you know, the history of the Hamakua coast, which is primarily agricultural, and you know, with the sugar plantations, and throughout the, you know, throughout the process that we've gone through, as well as past community processes, the vision and, you know, the values are pretty much similar. That people wanted, love the you know, the rural and agricultural character of the Hamakua coast, and would like to see it stay that way, and at the same time recognizing that you know, times are changing, you know, there are a lot of people moving here, as well as the, you know, the desire for you know, how do we you know, build an economy that, you know, sort of replaces, you know, the, you know, all the land base that was used for the sugar plantations. And, you know, that's been a kind of a challenge.
You mentioned people moving here. Very often when people come, the idea of having more land, being able to have, if you will, sort of a gentleman farm is very attractive. But sometimes that's not attractive to people who would like to see it kept in a more rural and perhaps, you know, rural commercial venture for something new, new boutique farms that would actually be producing and adding to the value of the community. Has there been any of that?
Definitely. You know, yeah, and it's something that, you know, the, you know, it's not going to be solved, you know, strictly by the CDP, but I think, you know, as we all look forward to how do we chart the course for our future, you know, the question becomes, how do we preserve that? How do we, what kind of economy is it going to base? What kind of diversified economy? And how do we balance, you know, how do we provide for that economic base that, you know, provides, you know, living wage jobs, you know, as well as, you know, allows the, you know, the character to be maintained.
So what were some of those ideas of how to increase the economic value of the area without necessarily threatening the more rural character?
I think some of the, you know, the issues that came up, you know, has to do with, you know, how do we actually support, you know, the community. Really, the voice was for a sustainable economy. And I think, you know, we've learned from the past that, you know, perhaps the industrialized agricultural of the past, you know, wasn't always the best for the land itself. And at the same time now, so we have this large land base that are primarily for, you know, like you said, a lot of gentleman farmers. We still have a significant amount of ranching and, you know, that use, which preserves some of the open space. But how to then, you know, have it remain in agriculture and provide. So I guess, you know, the questions and issues that came up is, you know, how do we provide for, you know, that sustainable economy? And so some of the issues that were discussed were, you know, how do we support, you know, like smaller localized economy of, you know, smaller scale, more diversified farms, and help farmers get their products to the market. And then at the same time, also raising the crop of farmers, because as we all know, the population base for the farmer is, you know, it's quite old. And so how do we get young farmers, you know, to farm and then to do it, you know, in a way that, you know, they can make a living, you know, with the, you know, the land prices, the land prices continue to skyrocket. So that becomes a big issue for both the land base for farming as well as housing.
Brad, does this also mean that there are going to have to be some zoning changes?
I think that, you know, like the community process that we went through is really, you know, like the community's voice for kind of what would the community like to see. And now it goes through this whole, you know, adoption process through the planning department, through the county council, the Windward Planning Commission. And so there'll be lots more opportunities for, you know, community input. But we do, we definitely, you know, be looking, you know, towards, you know, that process to, so that the community development plan, which is a regional scale effort, can help inform the broader general plan, which is the overall island, vision. And vice versa, you know, so that, you know, they can be some, perhaps there may be some changes, but on the whole, you know, some patterns that have been in place, but also kind of tweaking some of those to realize that some of the zoning, current zoning, was, you know, a historical reflection of what we had in the past, and is that the, you know, the where we want it to go in the future.
And then before we go, what about in terms of expanding, townships and being able to build out some of what, you know, people might want to have more of, more restaurants, maybe more shops,
right?
That kind of thing that isn't certainly anything to do with big box retail, but would be something that would be supporting those people who are in the area who might like to have a little bit more of
exactly.
what would be available.
Exactly. And so I think one of the, you know, prevailing, comments that we heard was, you know, we want to, preserve, protect, and enhance our, you know, the existing plantation towns that we had, because they were, you know, the infrastructure is already there. And so we'd like to, you know, like support those and encourage, you know, development in smart and compact ways so that we don't, you know, move out into the surrounding ag lands, and then, you know, provide, as you mentioned, you know, like a larger and more robust, you know, local economy in those towns so that they can serve as hubs for our community, which they have done in the past.
Well, you've got a beautiful part of Hawaii there to be watching as it develops, and to help to develop it in a way that makes sense for the community. We'll be watching, too. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Brad Kurakawa lives in Honomu, on the Hilo Hamakua Coast, and he's also the chairperson of the Hamakua Community Development Plan Steering Committee. The Citizens Advisory Committee to the Hawaii County Planning Department is just sending the Hamakua plan to the county for review.
Aloha, I'm Benny Lee from The Platform. You're tuned in to HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we remembered the beginning of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, better known as OHA. We asked you what legislative event created OHA and in what year it took place. The Office of Hawaiian Affairs is charged with advancing the position of Native Hawaiians throughout Hawaii. It focuses in many areas, including education, economic self-sufficiency, language, public health, and more. The effort was undertaken as a result of a clause in the 1959 Admission Act. That act, which granted Hawaii statehood, stipulated that land be set in trust for the betterment of Native Hawaiians. And although that stipulation was laid out in 1959, it was not until the Hawaii State Constitutional Convention of 1978 that the Office of Hawaiian Affairs was created to fulfill the mandate.
And Mike May called us with the correct answer. He will be receiving the prize. Thanks so much for joining us for the Backyard Quiz for today. And if you've got a question for us that you might hear on a future show, send it to us for vetting at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, The 2017 Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations are February 6th through 9th on Kauai, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
The more stylized and serious the show, the more it invites parody, and it would be difficult to imagine a more ripe target for satire than Game of Thrones, with its dark and brooding tone, its exaggerated violence, and its reimagined Dark Ages setting. The night is dark and full of terrors, but that didn't stop Basil Considine and his cohorts from reimagining the popular TV show as a family-friendly musical. Game of Thrones, the musical, is coming to Hawaii, and Basil is on the line to tell us about it. Good morning, Basil.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure. I would imagine this was a pretty irresistible target for parody. Am I right?
It was. And, in fact, a lot of other people have done this in various media. There is a high school dating sitcom parody. There are game show parodies. But I thought there was a lot of room to do a musical, and especially to approach it from an unusual angle, which is how I ended up writing a Sesame Street-style parody complete with puppets.
Well, I would imagine if you're aiming for a family-friendly audience, you've got to back up on some of the violence, for one thing, yeah?
Well, actually, there was one area that we backed off a great deal. There is no sexual violence in this.
Uh-huh.
100% certified rape-free, as we advertised it in Minnesota,
well,
and also 100% nudity-free, which made my cast very happy.
Yeah, I dare say. It makes me happy to hear it, Basil, because, but, you know, the fact that it takes itself as seriously as it does is kind of what makes it a target for satire, yeah?
Oh, yes. To send up something that has no depth is very light, but to have something that has rich meanings and that resonates with people in different ways, that's when you start being able to have real humor and to hit other themes as well.
Well, what were the first things that you sort of went after when you were putting together the show?
Well, there are a couple really well-known lines in the show that we just had to do something with, and one of those was, "You know nothing, Jon Snow,"
uh-huh,
which became a children's nursery rhyme song in the show. Another was the line you gave earlier, "The night is dark and full of terrors,"
uh-huh,
which works its way into several of the scenes and monologues, as well as one song that Melisandre sings when trying to get Jon Snow to give in to her charms.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, the whole Starks dying right and left. We took the song "The Reigns of Castamere," which is alternately known as the Lannister song and the "Someone's Going to Die" song among Game of Thrones fans.
Uh-huh.
And we play with that. So every time someone important is about to die, you hear that sung. And for some of the puppets, that's a clue in of, wait, something's wrong. And then, of course, they die terrible deaths.
Well, so it's puppets. Is it live actors as well?
Live actors and puppets.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you're familiar with the British genre of panto.
Yeah.
Where you have a number of people, and part of the fun is that they're playing all these characters really fast, wigs flying everywhere, putting on costumes. And so we use the puppets in part for that. And people will go back and forth. The main characters are live actors acting with their whole body. But the people who tend to live shorter lives are portrayed by hand-arm puppets.
Because they're more easily disposed of, I would imagine.
Yes, and because for some reason using puppets makes everything funnier.
Yeah, it's sort of, I could see that. Well, you have the incredible complexity of, you know, when I've watched the show, I constantly getting mixed up over who's whom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with these different families. Do you sort of take that on, you know, the warring family themes?
Yes, and one of the challenges for the show was condensing such a rich amount of material down to a show we could do in under an hour. So we take each season and have some core part of the story that is presented as a special scene. You know, it's called out. The first one is The Tragic Tale of Eddard Stark, a puppet pantomime farce. And we've run through season one, and it, of course, ends with his getting his head chopped off.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, we run through each other season with a key narrative. We can't do everything, of course, but it's enough to, so people who have seen the show or seen the most famous bits on YouTube will definitely have a couple jokes just for them.
Well, you know, I was looking at the song titles for the show, and one of them is addressed to the character Jon Snow, and it's asked him to cheer up, which I think a lot of people would have liked to see for years now.
Well, I don't know about that, because there's a large number of women who still go for the tall, dark, and brooding.
Yeah, that's true. Sort of the modern-day James Dean with added layers of fur, yeah?
Get the fur and the leather.
Yeah, that's right. It's something for everyone. Are there, dare I ask, are there dragons in your show?
There is a brief appearance by dragons. Of course, the budget, whenever you have dragons, not only does it take a lot of money to feed them and then they burn things down, but
yeah.
They're really hard to check. So yeah. We managed to sneak the dragons in for one scene.
Well, you know, they don't appear that often in the show, probably for the same budgetary reasons, right? That's an expensive shot to get, a bunch of flying dragons.
Quite.
Well, let's see. How many in your cast have you got, Basil?
Well, in the original production, we had 7 cast members. And then when whittling it down to Hawaii in order to stay under budget and still be able to fly across the Pacific, we whittled it down to 5, so I was actually the music director pianist for the original production,
uh-huh.
And this time I'm taking a place on stage because I know the show well enough, having written it, to be able to manage some of the really fast transitions.
I would imagine. Did it, in some ways, did it kind of write itself? I mean, did you have a lot of input from the cast and, oh, you got to do a song about dragons or you got to do a song about Jon Snow, that kind of thing?
We did have a lot of input from the cast. So I would write scenes and monologues and songs and bring them in, and we did a extended workshop process, and the things that the cast really liked, you know, it was always clear from the beginning. You know, there were some scenes that were funny, but there were the ones that grabbed them, too. And that ended up shaping the narrative in some unexpected and unplanned ways.
So that really enhances your work as a writer, doesn't it, the whole workshop process?
Well, I am in the happy position of being able to take credit for things that other people gave input on, so there's that.
That's the secret.
It was a marvelous process. I'm definitely going to do this for some other pieces.
Well, that's a secret that many writers have benefited from, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. A chorus line was developed in a similar fashion where they just kept workshopping and bringing things in, and people would say, yes, I love that.
Yeah.
Or, I don't love that, but it makes me cry, and so we have to have it anyway. And if it's just one person making those calls, you might not end up with this fine, elegant balance.
No, that's how you make a show. Thanks a lot, Basil. Good to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Basil Considine is the stage director and one of the performers in Game of Thrones, the musical, which will be performed next Thursday and Friday at Next Door in Honolulu and Saturday the 21st at Iao Theater in Wailuku, Maui.
John! Cheer up, John Snow!
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, presenting bassist Kyle Eastwood on stage January 10th through the 15th. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Chris Gethard, his off-Broadway show Career Suicide, is a comic monologue about dealing with depression and suicidal thoughts. Gethard also co-starred in Mike Birbiglia's film Don't Think Twice about an improv comedy group. Gethard did improv for years with the Upright Citizens Brigade. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
Beth Ann, kids in school today are getting a chance to not only eat good food, but actually learn about it.
Well, and that's part of the whole issue of the, you know, farm to school movement, and hearing what Chef Greg had to say earlier about involving the kids so intimately, going from class to class, giving them samples.
Yeah.
Of not a lot of schools that have been able to do that kind of thing, and certainly we'll see where this goes for the rest of the pilot program. I understand it's going to Maui next, so kids will have a chance to weigh in.
There's life after macaroni and cheese.
A lot of life and a lot of good taste, too. That's going to do it for us for this week and for this Friday. We're going to be back with you on Monday. And you know that KHET has some beautiful new digs, but as for its old building, well, the Academy for Creative Media is petitioning to be able to move into it. We're going to talk with ACM Professor Joel Moffitt.
And we'll find out what happens when a stage kiss becomes all too real at Manoa Valley Theater.
Oh, that sounds intriguing. Meanwhile, we'd like to hear from you, and you can call us with your intriguing thoughts or anything else you have to say about the program or the station on our Talkback line. It's 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
A playlist of the music you hear on the show can be heard at hawaiipublicradio.org. And our executive producer is Bethann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants.
John DeMello wrote our backyard quiz theme. And I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Bethann Kozlovich. We'll see you on Monday when we pick up the conversation. Enjoy your weekend.